and universities for women.
And the conversation at once veered to a new subject, the education of women. Karenin expressed the view that the higher education of women is generally confounded with the question of women's emancipation, and that was the only reason for considering it injurious.
I, on the contrary, think that these two questions are firmly bound together, said Pestsov. It is a vicious circle. Women are deprived of rights because of their lack of education, and their lack of education results from their lack of rights. We must not forget that the subjection of women is so widespread and so old that we often refuse to recognize the abyss that separates them from us.
You said rights, remarked Koznishev, who had been waiting for Pestsov to stop. The right of serving on a jury, on town councils, of being presidents of local government boards, civil servants, members of parliament,
undoubtedly.
But if women, in some rare, exceptional cases, can fill these posts, it seems to me that you should not speak of rights. It would be more correct to say duties. Everybody will agree that when we fill the office of juryman, town councillor, or telegraph clerk, we feel that we are fulfilling a duty. So it would be more correct to say that women are seeking for duties, and quite rightly. And we must sympathize with this desire of others to help in man's work for the community.
You are quite right, said Karenin. I think the only question is whether they are capable of fulfilling these duties.
In all probability, they will be extremely capable, interjected Oblonsky, when education is more widely diffused among them. We see this.
And how about the old proverb, remarked the old prince, who had long been listening to the conversation with a humorous twinkle in his small, glittering eyes.
My daughters won't mind my mentioning it. Women's hair is long, but their wits...
They thought the same of the Negroes before their emancipation, said Pestsov angrily.
The thing that seems strange to me is that women should look for new duties, said Koznishev, while, as we see, men, unfortunately, generally avoid theirs.
Duties are connected with rights, power, money, honours. That is what women are seeking, said Pestsov.
It is just as if I were to strive for the right of being a wet nurse and were offended because they pay women for it and won't pay me, said the old prince.
Turovtsin burst into loud laughter, and Koznishev felt sorry he had not made that remark himself. Even Karenin smiled.
"Yes, but a man can't be a wet nurse," said Pestsov, "while a woman..."
"Oh, yes, an Englishman on board ship did once nurse his baby," said the old prince, allowing himself this indelicacy in his daughter's presence.
"There will be about as many women officials as there are of such Englishmen," said Koznishev.
"Yes, but what is a girl to do if she has no home?"
said Oblonsky, agreeing with Pestsov and supporting him, and thinking of the dancer, Chibisova, whom he had in his mind all the time. "If you looked carefully into that girl's story, you would find that she had left her family, or a sister's family, where she might have done woman's work," said Dolly irritably, and unexpectedly intervening in the conversation. She probably guessed what girl her husband had in his mind.
"But we are defending a principle, an ideal," said Pestsov in his sonorous bass. "Women wish to have the right to be independent and educated. They are hampered and oppressed by the consciousness that this is impossible for them."
"And I am hampered and oppressed by the knowledge that they won't take me as a wet nurse in the foundlings hospital," repeated the old prince, to the great joy of Turovtsin, who laughed till he dropped the thick end of a piece of asparagus into the sauce.
Chapter 11. Everybody took part in the general conversation except Kitty and Levin. At first, when the influence of one nation on another was being talked about, thoughts of what he had to say on the subject involuntarily came into Levin's mind. But these thoughts, formerly so important to him, now only flickered through his mind as in a dream and were not of the slightest interest. It even struck him as strange that they should care to talk about things that could make no difference to anyone. In the same way, what was being said about the rights and the education of women should have interested Kitty.
How often she had thought about that question when she remembered her friend abroad and the irksome state of dependence in which Varenka lived. How often she had wondered what would be her own fate if she did not get married, and how many times she had argued about it with her sister. But now it did not interest her at all. She and Lievin were carrying on their own separate conversation, and it was not even a conversation, but a kind of mystic intercourse, which every moment bound them closer and closer, and created in both a feeling of joyful fear before the unknown upon which they were entering. They began by Lievin's telling Kitty, in answer to her question of how he could have seen her in the carriage in the summer, how he was going back from the hayfields along the high road and met her.
"It was early in the morning. I expect you had only just woken up. Your mother was asleep in her corner. It was a lovely morning. I was going along and wondering who that could be in a four-horsed coach, a splendid team with bells. And for an instant, you appeared. And I saw you at the window, sitting like this, holding the strings of your cap with both hands and thinking very deeply about something," he said, and smiled. "How I wish I knew what you were thinking about. Something important?" Was I not very untidy? She thought. But seeing the rapturous smile which the recollection of these details evoked, she felt that the impression she had produced was a very pleasing one. She blushed and laughed joyously. "I really don't remember." "How pleasantly Turovtsin laughs," said Lievin, looking with pleasure at his moist eyes and shaking body. "Have you known him long?" asked Kitty.
"Who does not know him?"
"I see you think he is a bad man."
"Not bad, but a mere cipher."
"He is not. Change your opinion quickly," said Kitty. "I, too, did not think much of him, but he is a dear fellow and wonderfully kind-hearted. He has a heart of gold."
"How did you manage to find out his heart?"
"He and I are great friends. I know him very well. Last winter, soon after you came to us," she said with a penitent and at the same time a trustful smile, "Dolly's children all had scarlet fever, and he happened to call. And fancy," she went on in a whisper, "he was so sorry for her that he stopped and helped her to nurse the children. Really, he stayed 3 weeks in the house and looked after the children like a nurse."
"I'm telling Konstantin Dmitrich about Turovtsin and the scarlet fever," she said, leaning over toward her sister.
"Yes? Oh, it was wonderful. He is splendid," said Dolly, looking toward Turovtsin, who felt that he was being talked about, and giving him a gentle smile.
Lievin looked at Turovtsin again and wondered how it was he had failed to realize what a charming man he was.
"I am sorry. Very sorry. I shall never again think ill of anyone," he said, merrily, expressing what he sincerely felt at the moment.
Chapter 12. In the conversation which had been begun on the rights of women, there were raised some questions not freely to be discussed in the presence of ladies concerning the inequalities of marriage relations. Pestsov more than once during dinner time flew at these questions, but Koznishev and Oblonsky carefully diverted him from them. When they rose from table and the ladies had left the room, Pestsov did not follow them, but turned to Karenin and began to state the chief cause of inequality. The inequality between husband and wife, in his opinion, lay in the fact that the infidelity of a wife and that of a husband were unequally punished, both by law and by public opinion. Oblonsky hurriedly offered Karenin a cigar.
"No, I don't smoke," quietly replied Karenin.
And, as if wishing to show that he was not afraid of the conversation, he turned with a cold smile to Pestsov.
"I imagine that the cause of the prevailing opinion lies in the very nature of things," he said, and was about to go to the drawing-room, but Turovtsin quite unexpectedly addressed him.
"Have you heard about Priyachnikov?"
said Turovtsin, animated by the champagne he had drunk and impatient to break his silence, which had long oppressed him. And with a kindly smile on his moist and rosy lips, he went on addressing himself chiefly to Karenin, the principal guest. Vasya Pryachnikov, as I was told today, has fought a duel with Kvitsky and killed him. As one always seems to knock a sore place, so that day Oblonsky felt that unfortunately the conversation kept striking Karenin's sore place. He again made an attempt to draw his brother-in-law away, but Karenin himself asked with interest, "What did Pryachnikov fight about?"
"His wife. He behaved like a brick, challenged the other, and killed him."
"Oh," said Karenin indifferently, and raising his eyebrows he went to the drawing-room. "I'm so glad you came," said Dolly, with a frightened smile, as she met him in the sitting-room through which he had to pass. "I must speak with you. Let us sit down here." Karenin, with the same look of indifference produced by his raised eyebrows, sat down beside her and feigned a smile. "Yes," he said, "especially as I wish to ask you to excuse me for having to go away at once. I am leaving Moscow tomorrow." Dolly was firmly convinced of Anna's innocence, and felt herself growing pale and her lips trembling from anger with this cold, unfeeling man who so calmly intended to ruin her innocent friend. "Alexei Alexandrovich," she said, looking into his eyes with desperate determination, "I asked you about Anna, and you did not give me an answer. How is she?" "I think she is well, Darya Alexandrovna," replied Karenin, without looking at her. "Alexei Alexandrovich, forgive me, I have no right to... But I love Anna like a sister, and respect her, and I beg, I implore you to tell me what has happened between you. What do you accuse her of?" Alexei Alexandrovich winced, and almost closing his eyes, bowed his head. "I expect your husband has told you the reasons which make me consider it necessary to change my former relations with Anna Arkadyevna," he said, without looking in her eyes, discontentedly eyeing Shcherbatsky, who was passing through the sitting-room.
I don't believe it, I cannot believe it," Dolly said, clasping her bony hands with an energetic movement.
She rose quickly, put her hand on Karenin's sleeve, and said, "We shall be disturbed here. Come this way, please." Dolly's excitement affected Karenin. He rose and obediently followed her into the schoolroom. They sat down at the table, covered with leather cloth, all cut about with penknives.
"I don't believe it. I don't," she uttered,
trying to catch his eyes, which avoided hers.
"One can't disbelieve facts, Darya Alexandrovna," said he, emphasizing the word facts.
"But what has she done?" asked Darya Alexandrovna.
"What is it she has done?"
"She has despised her duties and betrayed her husband. That is what she has done," he said.
"No, no, it can't be. No, for God's sake, you are mistaken," said Dolly, raising her hands to her temples and closing her eyes.
Karenin smiled coldly with his lips only, wishing to prove to her and to himself the firmness of his conviction. But this passionate defense, though it did not shake him, lacerated his wound. He began speaking with more animation.
"It is difficult to make a mistake when a wife herself announces to her husband that 8 years of married life and a son have all been an error, and that she wants to begin life from the beginning again," he said, crossly, sniffing.
"Anna and vice? I cannot combine them. I cannot believe it."
"Darya Alexandrovna," he said, now looking straight at Dolly's kind, excited face and feeling his tongue involuntarily loosened, "I would give much for the possibility of doubting. While I was in doubt, it was hard, but not so hard as it is now. While I doubted, I had hope. But now there is no hope left, and all the same, I doubt everything. I doubt everything so much that I hate my son, and sometimes believe he is not my son. I am very unhappy. There was no need for him to say this. Dolly had understood it as soon as he looked her in the face. She felt sorry for him, and her faith in her friend's innocence was shaken.
Oh, it is terrible, terrible! But can it be true that you have decided on a divorce?
I have decided to take the final step. There is nothing else for me to do.
Nothing to do? Nothing to do?
She muttered, with tears in her eyes. No, there is something else to do, she said. That is just what is so terrible in this kind of grief, that you can't do as in all other troubles, losses or deaths, just bear your cross. But here you must act, he said, as if guessing her thoughts. You must come out of the degrading position in which you are placed. It is impossible to live free together.
I understand very well, said Dolly,
and her head dropped. She was silent, thinking of herself and her own sorrow, and then suddenly and energetically she raised her head and folded her hands as in prayer.
But wait. You are a Christian. Think of her. What will become of her if you throw her off?
I have thought, Darya Alexandrovna, and have thought deeply, said Karenin. His face flushed in blotches, and his dim eyes looked straight at her. Dolly now pitied him with all her heart. I did that very thing when she herself informed me of my shame. I let everything go on as before. I gave her a chance to turn over a new leaf, and I tried to save her. With what result? She disregarded my very easy demand that she should observe the proprieties, he went on, getting heated. One may save a person who does not wish to perish, but if a nature is so spoilt and depraved that it regards ruin as salvation, what can one do? Anything but divorce, answered Dolly. But what is anything?
No, this is too awful. She will be nobody's wife. She will be ruined.
What can I do? Said Karenin, shrugging his shoulders and raising his eyebrows. The recollection of his wife's last delinquency irritated him so much that he again became as cold as he had been at the beginning of the conversation. I am very grateful for your sympathy, but it is time for me to go, he said, rising.
No. Wait a bit. You should not ruin her. Wait a bit. I will tell you about myself. I married, and my husband deceived me. In my anger and jealousy, I wished to abandon everything. I myself wished... But I was brought to my senses. And by whom? Anna saved me. And here I am living, my children growing, my husband returns to the family and feels his error, grows purer and better, and I live. I have forgiven, and you must forgive.
Karenin listened, but her words no longer affected him. All the bitterness of the day when he decided on a divorce rose again in his soul. He gave himself a shake and began to speak in a loud and piercing voice. I cannot forgive. I don't wish to and don't think it would be right. I have done everything for that woman, and she has trampled everything in the mud which is natural to her. I am not a cruel man. I have never hated anyone, but I hate her with the whole strength of my soul, and I cannot even forgive her because I hate her so much for all the wrong she has done me. He said with tears of anger, choking him.
Love those that hate you,
whispered Dolly, shamefacedly. Karenin smiled contemptuously. He had long known all that, but it could not apply to his case.
Love them that hate you, but you can't love them whom you hate. Forgive me for having upset you. Everyone has trouble enough of his own.
And having got himself under control, Karenin quietly rose, said goodbye, and went away. Chapter 13. When everybody was leaving the table, Levin wanted to follow Kitty into the drawing room, but was afraid she would not like it because it would make his attentions to her too obvious. So he stopped with the group of men taking part in their conversation. But without looking through the open door at Kitty, he was conscious of her movements, her looks, and the place in the drawing room where she sat. He began at once, and without the slightest effort, to fulfill the promise he had made her of thinking well of and always liking everybody. The conversation had turned to the question of village communes, in which Pestsov saw some special principle which he called the chorus principle. Levin did not agree either with Pestsov or with his brother Sergei, who, in a way of his own, both admitted and did not admit the importance of the Russian communal system. But he talked to them only with the idea of getting them to agree and softening their controversy. He was not at all interested in what he himself said, still less in what they were saying, and only desired one thing, that everybody should feel contented and pleased. He now knew the one thing that was important, and that one thing was at first there in the drawing-room, but afterwards began moving and paused in the doorway. Without looking round, he felt a pair of eyes and a smile directed toward him, and he could not help turning. She stood in the doorway with Shcherbatsky and was looking at him. "I thought you were going to the piano," he said, moving toward her. "That is what I miss in the country, music."
"No, we were only coming to call you away." "Thank you for coming," she said, rewarding him with a smile, as with a gift. "What is the use of arguing? No one ever convinces another."
"Yes, you're quite right," said Levin. "For the most part, people argue so warmly only because they cannot make out what it is that their opponent wants to prove."
Levin had often noticed in arguments among the most intelligent people that after expending enormous efforts and an immense number of logical subtleties and words, the disputants at last became conscious of the fact that the thing they had been at such pains to prove to one another had long ago, from the very beginning of the controversy, been known to them, but that they liked different things and were disinclined to mention what they liked lest it should be attacked. He had experienced the fact that sometimes, in the middle of a discussion, one understands what it is that one's opponent likes, and suddenly likes it oneself, and immediately agrees with him, when all proofs become superfluous and unnecessary. Sometimes the reverse happens. One at last mentions the thing one likes, for the sake of which one has been devising arguments, and if this is said well and sincerely, one's opponent suddenly agrees and ceases to dispute. This was what he wanted to express. She wrinkled her forehead, trying to understand, but as soon as he began to explain, she understood.
"I see. One must find out what one's opponent is contending for, what he likes, and then one can."
She had completely grasped and found the right expression for his badly expressed thought. Levin smiled joyfully. He was so struck by the change from the confused, wordy dispute with his brother and Pestsov to this laconic, clear, and almost wordless communication of a very complex idea. Shcherbatsky left them, and Kitty went up to a table prepared for cards, sat down, took a piece of chalk, and began drawing concentric circles on the new green cloth of the table. They went back to the conversation at dinner about women's rights and occupations. Levin agreed with Dolly that a girl who does not get married can find woman's work in the family. He supported this view by saying that no family can dispense with a help, and that in every family, rich or poor, there are and must be nurses, either paid or belonging to the family. "No," said Kitty, blushing, but looking all the more boldly at him with her truthful eyes. "A girl may be so placed that she cannot enter into a family without humiliation, while she herself..." He understood the allusion. "Oh, yes," he said. "Yes, yes, yes, you're right, you're right." And he understood all that Pestsov at dinner had been trying to prove about the freedom of women, simply because he saw in Kitty's heart fear of the humiliation of being an old maid, and, loving her, he too felt that fear and humiliation, and at once gave up his contention. There was a pause. She still continued drawing on the table with the chalk. Her eyes shone with a soft light. Submitting to her mood, he felt in his whole being an ever-increasing stress of joy. "Oh, I have scribbled over the whole table," she said, and putting down the chalk, moved as if to get up. "How can I remain here alone, without her?" he thought, horror-struck, and took up the chalk. "Don't go," he said, and sat down at the table. "I have long wished to ask you something." He looked straight into her kind, though frightened, eyes. "Please do." "There," he said, and wrote the following letters. Capital W, Y, A, I, C, N, B, D, Y, M, T, O, N. These letters stood for, "When you answered, it cannot be. Did you mean then or never?" It was quite unlikely that she would be able to make out this complicated sentence, but he looked at her with an expression as if his life depended on her understanding what those letters meant. She glanced seriously at him, and then, leaning her frowning forehead on her hand, began reading. Occasionally she looked up at him, her look asking him, "Is it what I think?" "I have understood," she said with a blush. "What word is this?" he asked, pointing to the N which stood for never. "That word is never," she said, "but it is not true." He quickly rubbed out what he had written, handed her the chalk, and rose. She wrote, "Capital T, capital I, C-N-A-O." Dolly's sorrow, caused by her talk with Karenin, was quite dispelled when she saw those two figures. Kitty with the chalk in her hand, looking up at Levin with a timid, happy smile, and his fine figure bending over the table with his burning eyes fixed now on the table, now on her. Suddenly his face beamed. He had understood. The letters meant, "Then I could not answer otherwise." He looked at her questioningly and timidly. "Only then?" "Yes," answered her smile. "And N? And now?" he said. "Well then, read this. I will tell you what I wish, what I very much wish." And she wrote these initial letters. Capital T, Y, M, F, A, F, W, H. This meant that you might forgive and forget what happened. He seized the chalk with nervous, trembling fingers, broke it, and wrote the initial letters of the following. "I have nothing to forget or forgive. I never ceased to love you." She looked at him with a smile that remained fixed on her lips. "I understand," she whispered. He sat down and wrote out a long sentence. She understood it all, and without asking if she was right, took the chalk and wrote the answer at once. For a long time he could not make out what she meant, and he often looked up in her eyes. He was dazed with happiness. He could not find the words she meant at all, but in her beautiful eyes, radiant with joy, he saw all that he wanted to know. And he wrote down three letters. But before he had finished writing, she read it under his hand, finished the sentence herself, and wrote the answer, "Yes."
"Playing secretary," said the old prince, approaching them. "Come now, we must be going, if you mean to come to the theatre."
Levin rose and accompanied Kitty to the door. Everything had been said in that conversation. She had said that she loved him and would tell her father and mother, and he had said that he would call in the morning. Chapter 14. When Kitty had left and Levin remained alone, he felt so restless without her and so impatient to live more and more quickly through the hours till morning, when he would see her again and be united to her for good, that he dreaded like death the 14 hours he would have to spend without her. In order not to be alone and to deceive time, he needed to be with and to talk to somebody. Oblonsky would have been the pleasantest companion for him now, but he was going to an evening party, as he said, really to the ballet. Levin only had time to tell him he was happy and fond of him and would never, never forget what he had done for him. Oblonsky's look and smile showed Levin that he understood him rightly.
"Then it's not time to die yet," said Oblonsky with feeling, pressing Levin's hand.
"No," said Levin.
Dolly, too, when saying goodbye to him, spoke as if congratulating him, saying,
"I am so glad you and Kitty have met again. We must value old friendship."
Levin did not like her remark. She did not understand how high and unattainable for her all this was, and she should not have dared to refer to it. Levin took leave of them, but not to remain alone, he fastened on to his brother.
"Where are you going?"
"To a town council meeting."
"Well, I'll come with you. May I?"
"Why not?
Let us go,"
answered Koznishev, smiling.
"What has happened to you today?"
"To me,
happiness is with me,"
said Levin, letting down the window of the carriage in which they were driving.
"You don't mind? It is so stuffy here. Happiness is with me. Why have you never got married?"
Koznishev smiled. "I am very glad. She seems a fine girl," he began.
Don't speak,"
exclaimed Levin, seizing the collar of his brother's fur coat and lapping it over his face. "She is a fine girl," were words so ordinary, so insignificant, so inappropriate to his feelings. Koznishev laughed merrily, a thing he rarely did.
"Anyhow, I may say I am very glad." "You may say that tomorrow." "Tomorrow, but nothing more." "Nothing, nothing." "Silence," said Levin,
and again wrapping the collar round his brother's face, he added,
"I am very fond of you. Will they really let me into the meeting?"
"Of course you can come."
"What are you speaking on tonight?"
asked Levin, not ceasing to smile. They arrived at the council, and Levin listened to the secretary haltingly reading an official report which he evidently did not understand himself, but from his face Levin saw what a nice, kind, and splendid fellow he was. That was plain from the confused and embarrassed manner in which he read the report. Then followed the discussion. They were debating the grant of some money and the laying of some pipes, and Koznishev spoke about something for a long time in a triumphant tone and stung two of the members. Another member, having noted something on a bit of paper, started timidly, but went on to answer him very venomously and neatly. And then Sviatsky, he too was there, also said something very finely and nobly. Levin listened to them and clearly saw that neither the sums of money nor the pipes had any real existence. There was nothing of the kind.
and he saw also that they were not at all angry, but were all very kind and estimable fellows, and that it was all very good and pleasant. They were doing no one any harm, and everybody was pleased. What seemed remarkable to Levin was that they were all perfectly transparent to him that day, and that by means of little signs which he had never noticed before, he recognized the soul of each, and clearly saw that they were all kind, and, in particular, were all extremely fond of him. That was quite evident from the way they spoke to him, and the tenderness and affection with which they all, even strangers, looked at him.
"Well, are you contented?" asked Koznishev.
"Quite. I never thought it would be so interesting. Fine. Splendid."
Sviatsky came up and asked Levin to come home with him and have some tea. Levin could not at all think or remember why he had ever felt dissatisfied with Sviatsky, or what he had thought lacking in him. He was an intelligent and remarkably kind fellow.
"I shall be very pleased," said Levin, and asked about Sviatsky's wife and sister-in-law.
And by a strange connection of ideas, as that sister-in-law was connected in his fancy with the idea of marriage, it appeared to him that he could not tell anybody of his happiness so appropriately as Sviatsky's wife and sister-in-law, and he was very glad to go and see them. Sviatsky questioned him about his affairs in the country, as usual disbelieving in the possibility of devising anything that had not already been discovered in Western Europe. But now Levin did not consider this at all unpleasant. On the contrary, he felt that Sviatsky was right, and that the whole business was insignificant, and he noticed the wonderful gentleness and delicacy with which Sviatsky avoided saying that he was right. The ladies were especially nice. It seemed to Levin that they already knew all about it and sympathized with him, but did not mention it out of delicacy. He remained at the house 2 or 3 hours, talking about different matters, but thinking only of the one thing that filled his soul, and not noticing that they were dreadfully weary of him and ought long ago to have been in bed. Sviatsky, yawning, showed him to the hall, and wondered at the strange state his friend was in. It was past 1. Levin returned to the hotel, and the thought of how, with his impatience, he would spend the remaining 10 hours frightened him. The attendant on duty lighted his candle and was going away, but Levin stopped him. Igor, the attendant, of whom Levin had taken no notice heretofore, turned out to be a very intelligent, good, and above all, very kind man.
"I say, Igor, don't you find it difficult to keep awake?"
"What's one to do? Our work is of that sort. It is easier in a gentleman's house, but one earns more here."
It turned out that Igor had a family, 3 boys and a girl who was a seamstress and whom he wanted to marry to an assistant in a harness business. Levin took this opportunity to express to Igor his opinion that in marriage the chief thing is love, and that when there is love there will always be happiness, because happiness lies always within oneself. Igor listened very attentively, and evidently quite understood Levin, but in confirmation of it remarked, quite unexpectedly to Levin, that when he was in the service of nice people he was always satisfied with his masters, and that he was satisfied with his present master, although he was a Frenchman.
"A wonderfully kind man," thought Levin.
"And you, Igor, when you married, did you love your wife?"
"How can one help it?" answered Igor.
And Levin saw that Igor, too, was in an exultant state and wished to tell him all his most intimate feelings.
"My life, too, was very curious. From a child, I..."
he began with shining eyes, evidently infected by Levin's exultation as men get infected by others' yawning. But at that moment a bell rang. Igor went away and Levin remained alone. He had scarcely eaten anything at dinner, and had refused both tea and supper at Sviatsky's, but could not think of eating. He had not slept the night before, but could not think of sleep either. The room was cool, but he felt suffocated with heat. He opened the little window and sat down on a table in front of it. Beyond a snow-covered roof he could see a gilt fretwork cross adorned with chains on the dome of a church, and above it the three-cornered constellation of the charioteer with the bright yellow star, Capella. He looked now at the cross, now at the star, and inhaled the fresh, frosty air which flowed with a regular current into the room, following, as in a dream, the images and memories that arose in his fancy. Towards 4 o'clock he heard steps in the corridor and looked out. It was the gambler, Myaskin, whom he knew, returning from the club. He passed dejectedly, frowning and coughing.
"Poor, unfortunate fellow," thought Lievin, and tears of affection and pity for the man filled his eyes.
He wished to speak to him and comfort him, but recollecting that he had nothing over his shirt, he changed his mind and again sat down in front of the little window to bathe in the cold air and to gaze at that beautifully shaped silent cross, full of meaning for him, and at the ascending bright yellow star. When it was past 6 o'clock, he began to hear the floor polishers and the church bell ringing for service, and felt he was beginning to grow cold. He shut the little window, washed, dressed, and went out into the street. Chapter 15. The streets were still empty. Lievin went to the Shcherbatskys' house. The front door was locked. Everybody was still sleeping. He went back to his room in the hotel and ordered coffee. The day waiter, not Igor this time, brought it to him. Lievin wished to have a talk with him, but the bell rang and the waiter went away. Lievin tried to drink a little coffee and put a piece of roll into his mouth, but his mouth could do nothing with it. He took the piece out of his mouth, put on his overcoat, and went out to walk about again. It was past 9 when he reached the Shcherbatskys' porch a second time. The inmates of the house were only just up, and the cook was going out to buy provisions. It would be necessary to live through another 2 hours at least. All that night and morning, Lievin had lived quite unconsciously and felt quite outside the conditions of material existence. He had not eaten for a whole day, had not slept for 2 nights, had spent several hours half-dressed and exposed to the frost, yet he felt not only fresher and better than ever before, but quite independent of his body. He moved without his muscles making any effort, and felt capable of anything. He was sure that he could fly upwards or knock down the corner of a house were it necessary. He spent the rest of the time walking about the street, looking at his watch and gazing around. And what he then saw, he never saw again. 2 children going to school, some pigeons that flew down from the roof, and a few loaves put outside a baker's window by an invisible hand touched him particularly. These loaves, the pigeons, and the 2 boys seemed creatures not of this earth. It all happened at the same time. One of the boys ran after a pigeon and looked smilingly up at Lievin. The pigeon flapped its wings and fluttered up, glittering in the sunshine amid the snow dust that trembled in the air. From the window came the scent of fresh-baked bread, and the loaves were put out. All these things were so unusually beautiful that Lievin laughed and cried with joy. After a long round, through the Gazetny Street and the Kislovka, he returned to the hotel, put his watch in front of him, and sat down, waiting till it should be 12. In the next room they were saying something about machines and fraud and coughing, as people do of a morning. They did not realize that the watch hand was drawing nearer to 12. The hand reached 12. Lievin went out into the porch. The Izvorschiks evidently knew all about it. With joyful faces they surrounded Lievin, disputing among themselves and offering him their services. Trying not to offend the others and promising to let them too drive him later on, he hired one and told him to drive to the Shcherbatskys. The Izvorschik was charming with the white band of his shirt showing from under his coat and clinging closely to his full, red, sturdy neck. That Izvozchik's sledge was high and comfortable, and never after did Lievin drive in one like it. And the horse was a good one, too, and tried its best to trot fast, but did not seem to move. The Izvozchik knew the Shcherbatskys' house, and rounding his elbows in a manner specially respectful to his fare, called, "Whoop!" and stopped at the porch. The Shcherbatskys' hall porter certainly knew everything. That was evident from the smile in his eyes and the tone in which he said,
"It's long since you were here last, Konstantin Dmitrich."
Not only did he know everything, but he evidently rejoiced and made efforts to hide his joy. Glancing into his kind old eyes, Lievin felt something new, even in his happiness.
"Are they up?" "Come in, sir. Won't you leave it here?" he said,
when Lievin turned back for his cap. That meant something. "Whom shall I announce you to?" asked the footman. The footman was young, of the new-fashioned kind, and a dandy, but a very kind and good fellow, and he too understood it all.
"The prince, the princess, the young lady," said Lievin.
The first person he met was Mlle. Linon. She was passing through the dancing hall, and her curls and her face shone. He had scarcely begun to speak to her when he heard the rustle of a dress outside the door. His eyes no longer saw Mlle. Linon, and the joyful terror of the nearness of his happiness seized him. Mlle. Linon hurriedly left him and went toward the other door. As soon as she had gone out, he heard the sound of very, very rapid, light steps on the parquet floor. And his joy, his life, his own self, the best in himself, that which he had sought and yearned for so long, advanced very, very rapidly towards him. She did not walk, but was borne toward him by some invisible force. He saw nothing but her clear, true eyes, frightened by the same joy of love which filled his own heart. Those eyes beamed nearer to him, dazzling him with their glow of love. She stopped so close that she touched him. Her arms rose, and her hands dropped on his shoulders. She had done everything she could. She had run up to him and given herself entirely, shyly, and joyfully. He put his arms round her and pressed his lips to her mouth that was waiting for his kiss. She too had not slept all night and had waited for him the whole morning. Her mother and father had definitely given their consent and were happy in her happiness. She had waited for him. She had wished to be the first to announce to him his and her joy. She had prepared herself to meet him alone, and had rejoiced at the idea, yet had felt timid and bashful, and had not known what she would do. She had heard his step and his voice, and had waited behind the door for Mlle. Linon to go. Mlle. Linon had gone away. Without thinking or asking herself what next, she had come to him and acted as she had. "Come to Mama," she said, taking him by the hand. For some time he could not say anything, not so much because he feared that words might spoil the loftiness of his feelings, as because every time he wished to speak he felt that instead of words, tears of joy would come. He took her hand and kissed it.
"Can it be true?" he said at last in a smothered voice. "Dear, I cannot believe that you love me."
She smiled at the word "dear," and at the timid look he gave her. "Yes," she said, significantly and slowly. "I am so happy." Without letting go of his hand, she entered the drawing room. The princess, on seeing them, breathed quickly and immediately burst into tears. Then she at once laughed and ran up to them with energy such as Lievin never expected from her, and putting her arms round his head, kissed him and wetted his cheeks with her tears.
"Then it's all finished. I am so glad.
love her. I am so glad. Kitty.
Well, you've settled it quickly, said the old prince, trying to be indifferent. But Lievin noticed that his eyes were moist when he addressed him.
I have always wished it, said the old prince, taking Lievin's hand and drawing him nearer. Even at the time when this scatterbrain intended...
Papa! Exclaimed Kitty, and closed his mouth with her hands.
Well, well, I won't, he said. I am very, very pleased. Oh, how stupid I am.
He embraced Kitty, kissed her face, her hand, then her face again, and made the sign of the cross over her. And Lievin was seized with a new feeling of affection for this man who had been strange to him before, when he saw how Kitty long and tenderly kissed his fleshy hand. Chapter 16 The princess sat in her armchair, silently smiling, and the prince seated himself beside her. Kitty stood close to her father's chair, still holding his hand. No one spoke. The princess was the first to break the silence and bring all their thoughts and feelings back to the practical side of life, and for the first moments this seemed strange and even painful to them all. When is it to be? There is the betrothal, and cards must be sent out. And when is the wedding to be? What do you think, Alexander?
Here he is, said the old prince, pointing to Lievin. He is the principal person concerned.
When? Said Lievin, blushing.
Tomorrow. If you ask me, the betrothal today and the wedding tomorrow.
Oh, don't, mon cher. What nonsense.
Well, then, next week.
He seems quite mad.
Why not?
What an idea, said the mother, with a pleased smile at his haste. And the trousseau?
Is it possible that there must be a trousseau and all that sort of thing? Lievin thought, horror-struck. However, as if a trousseau and a betrothal ceremony and all that could spoil my happiness, nothing can spoil it.
He looked up at Kitty and noticed that the thought of a trousseau did not in the least upset her, so he thought,
It is necessary, evidently.
Well, you see, I don't know at all. I only expressed my wish, he said, to excuse himself.
Then we will decide. We can have the betrothal and send out the cards at once. That will be all right.
The princess went up to her husband, kissed him, and was about to go away, but he stopped her, embraced her, and tenderly, like a young lover, kissed her several times with a smile. The old couple seemed to have become confused for the moment and not to know whether it was they who were again in love or only their daughter. When they had gone, Lievin came up to his betrothed and took her hand. He had now mastered himself and was able to speak, and there was much he had to say to her. But what he said was not at all what he had intended.
How well I knew it would happen! I never dared hope, yet in my soul I was always certain, said he.
I believe it was predestined. And I, she said. Even when... She stopped. And again went on, her truthful eyes looking into his face resolutely. Even when I drove my happiness from me, I always loved you only. But I was carried away. I must ask you, can you forget it?
Perhaps it was all for the best. You have much to forgive me. I must tell you.
He referred to one of the things he had decided to tell her. He meant to confess from the first about two matters, that he was not as pure as she, and that he was an agnostic. It was painful, but he thought he ought to tell her both these things.
No, not now, later, he said.
All right, later, but certainly tell me. I am afraid of nothing. I must know everything. Now it's settled.
He finished the sentence. It is settled that you will have me whatever I may be. You will not reject me. Yes?
Yes. Yes.
Their conversation was interrupted by Mademoiselle Linon, who, with a feigned yet affectionate smile, came to congratulate her favourite pupil. Before she had gone out, the servants entered with their congratulations. Afterwards, relatives arrived, and that beatific tumult began, which did not cease until the day after the wedding. All that time, Lievin felt uncomfortable and bored, but the stress of his joy went on increasing. All that time he felt that many things he did not know were expected of him, but he did all he was told, and it all gave him joy. He had thought that his courtship would be quite unlike any other, that the ordinary conditions of courtship would spoil his peculiar happiness. But he ended by doing what others do, and his happiness was thereby only increased, becoming more and more peculiar to him, unlike anyone else's was or is. "Now we shall eat some sweets," said Mademoiselle Linon, and off went Lievin to buy sweets. "I am very pleased indeed," said Sviatsky. "I advise you to go to Fomin's for the flowers." "Are they necessary?" And off he went to Fomin's. His brother told him he ought to borrow some money, because he would have a lot of expense. There would be presents. Are presents required? And off he rushed to Fulda, the jeweller's. At the confectioner's, florist's, and jeweller's, he noticed that they were expecting him, that they were pleased to see him, and triumphed in his happiness just like everyone else with whom he had anything to do at that time. It was extraordinary that not only was everybody fond of him, but all the hitherto unsympathetic, cold, or indifferent persons were delighted with him, gave way to him in everything, treated his feelings with delicate consideration, and shared his own opinion that he was the happiest man on earth because his betrothed was the height of perfection. Kitty felt just the same. When the Countess Nordston took the liberty of hinting that she had hoped for something better, Kitty got so heated and proved so convincingly that no one on earth could be better than Lievin that the Countess had to admit it, and thereafter never encountered Lievin in Kitty's presence without a smile of delight. The confession he had promised her was the one painful episode of that time. He consulted the old prince, and with his permission gave Kitty his diary, which contained facts that were tormenting him. He had written the diary with the intention of showing it to his future bride-elect. The confession of his agnosticism passed without a remark. She was religious, and had never doubted the truth of her religion, but the lack of external religion in him did not affect her at all. She knew through her love his whole soul, and saw in it what she desired, and the fact that that spiritual condition is called agnosticism was quite indifferent to her. The other confession made her weep bitterly. Lievin had not handed her the diary without an inward struggle. He knew that between him and her there could and should be nothing secret, and therefore he decided that it was his duty. But he had not considered how the confession might affect her. He had not put himself in her place. Only when he came that evening, before going to the theatre, and entered her room to see in her tear-stained face the misery caused by the irremediable sorrow he had brought about, did he realise from that sweet, pathetic face what an abysm separated his tainted past from her dove-like purity. And he was horror-struck at what he had done.
Take those dreadful books back, she cried, pushing away the notebooks that lay on the table before her. Why did you give me them? But no, it was best after all, she added, pitying the despair on his face. But it is dreadful. Dreadful.
His head dropped, and he remained silent, unable to speak.
You will not forgive me?
He whispered.
Yes, I have
forgiven you. But it is dreadful.
However, his happiness was so great that this confession did not impair it, but only gave it a new tinge. She forgave him. But after that he felt yet more unworthy of her, morally bowed still lower before her, and valued still more highly his undeserved happiness.